Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. It is a gorgeous day in upstate New York. The sun is shining, and we are so very lucky today. We have a phenomenal show. We have two outstanding best-selling authors. Well, of course, I only have best-selling authors on my show. What can I tell you? And it is gorgeous. But before I introduce the authors, I would like to say a shout out to Vitarelli's in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And I want to thank the people at Vitarelli's and the Vitarelli family. They have the best Italian food in the world. And thank you for supporting my show on Blog Talk Radio and Book Discussion. And thank you for the great five-star service. Fran did her first restaurant review the other day on my Facebook wall. So you can read about Vitarelli's. They have a website. And if you tell them, they're on King's Highway in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and if you happen to go in there for lunch or something, tell them Fran from Blog Talk Radio sent you, and say hi to my favorite waitress, Tony. And right now, I would like to introduce Donna Fletcher Crowe, but I have to tell you something about her first. Donna Fletcher Crowe is an author of historical novels, including the epic Glastonbury, a novel of Christian England, which was awarded, get this, everybody, first place in historical fiction by the National Federation of Press Women. Donna's book, Unholy Communion, is what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Donna. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you, Fran. It's lovely to be here with you. And it's a beautiful day in Boise, Idaho, too.
Oh, good. How is it where you are, Bethany? Is it nice over there? Is it beautiful?
It is beautiful here.
Oh, good. I'm glad we have sunshine because I get really nervous when it rains during a show or a storm because then we have technical difficulties and then I just don't even want to know.
Oh.
So Donna's got two books, and Unholy Communion is the book we're going to talk about. But could you give everybody a little bit of a background of your first book and how you decided to write this particular series? It's called the Monastery Series, right?
The Monastery Murders.
And, Murders. That's what makes it
And Unholy
better.
Communion is actually number three in the book, in the series. The first one was called A Very Private Grave. And it introduces my heroine, Felicity, and Father Anthony. Felicity and her background is based completely on the background of our daughter, who studied classics at Oxford and taught school in London and discovered that teaching school, even in such an exciting city as London, can be rather boring. And so she took herself off to a theological college. Her Latin professor had told her that the church is one place where Latin is still being used today. And even though Felicity didn't have much of a church background, this appealed to her. And so she went to a theological college in a monastery. It is run by, the college is run by the monks. And in the first book, her favorite monk, lovely Father Dominic, who, again, is based on a real monk, was brutally murdered. The real one wasn't, but in the book he was. And Felicity's church history professor, Father Anthony, who is not a monk, I need to make that clear. It's important to know that he's not sworn to a celibate life, but he is a priest, is accused of the murder. And that launches Anthony and Felicity into their first investigative role. And then in the second book, A Darkly Hidden Truth, they have another one when a friend of theirs is murdered. And now in an Unholy Communion, Felicity has absolutely had it with dead bodies, particularly when one plummets over the roof of a tower that she's standing at the foot of and rolls to her feet, and she wants just some quiet time to, I will have to tell you by now, plan their wedding. And so Anthony says, come to Wales with me. It's beautiful in Wales. I'm taking a group of young people on a walk through some ancient pilgrimage grounds, and you'll be away from everything, and I promise you some quiet, peaceful time. And so she does, expecting just this lovely, idyllic ramble through the countryside. Well, not only is it some really rough walking, but also it soon becomes clear that they are being followed by shadowy figures, strange things occur, and then they find a body face down in a holy well. So even in lovely mystical Wales, Felicity isn't able to escape her, seems to be her destiny of being a detective.
I think that maybe she needs to go into that field and forget the rest at this particular
point. Well, she started out thinking she was going to be a priest. As I said, she didn't have much background in the church, but she liked what she knew, and she was going to change the world. All she had to do was become a priest, and she could make the world a better place single-handedly. And you have to give it to Felicity. She is full of enthusiasm. She's a bit rash, but she's very loyal and very energetic. At the end of the first book, she says to Anthony, "I thought I knew everything. Now I realize I don't know anything." So the rest of the series, it becomes a bit of a quest for Felicity, deciding what she really does need to be doing with her life. In the second book, she thinks she's going to be a nun. And so she says, "Oh, no, I can't help you with this investigation. I'm off on a discernment journey. I'm going to all these convents, and I'm going to choose one, and I'm going to take the veil." Well, it takes her the length of that novel to find out that that's not the right course for her. So Felicity is still searching, but I think that helps make her an interesting character.
Yes, she is an interesting character. There's a lot of me in her, too, I have to tell you.
Oh, good.
She's feisty. She doesn't give up. She says it the way she wants to say it. And she doesn't always look to see that she's not going to get in trouble. She's just going to keep doing it. She's headstrong, so she's so me. But to the minute I read about her, I said, okay, this character is really good. We cannot get rid of her. And you're not allowed to kill off. You're not allowed to kill her off. Not yet, anyway. But you also did a lot of, I learned a lot, because, you know, every time I read a historical fiction, I look up the research just to make sure that I get it when I do the review. I do, because I've read so many books, probably too many, and sometimes the research is wrong, and sometimes the research is right. And I don't ever tell the author that they're right or wrong. I just, you know, don't add the research into the book if I think it's off. But why did you include such extensive research about St. David in this particular novel? I was fascinated because I didn't know anything about him, so I'm sitting there saying, oh, really, this is really good. Okay, I'm learning this too. And as I'm reading the book, I'm taking notes because I read the manuscript, and then Adam sent me a copy of the real book, which is great.
Oh,
but he forgot to tell you to autograph it, but that we won't get him for that one, not yet. So why did you include such extensive research in this book and in other novels? And why did you include a lot of the history of the many other places that the pilgrims visited?
Well, one of my goals, particularly in this series, is to create in my reader an understanding and an appreciation for our heritage. It worries me in our present world that we live in, where everything is so new and everything moves so fast. I'm afraid that we are losing touch with our background, with our roots, and with our heritage. And so I always want to bring some of this into my books. Another goal that I have as a writer is to give my readers a you-are-there experience. A lot of my readers will never have the opportunity to walk along the mountaintops across southern Wales. But I want them to know what it would feel like if they did. And so that is why I try never to write about a place that I haven't visited. And then I try to put my readers there as I'm writing it. And one of the things that I always want to know when I am visiting a place or when I'm reading about a place is I want to know the history. I want to know the background. Not just what is it like now, but what was it like when the Romans were here, or if I'm writing in America, what was it like when the Indians were here, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And so that's why I do a lot of research, and then I bring it into the stories as much as I can. And then, of course, since this is a murder mystery, it's important to mention that there are clues buried in these stories. These are things that that the characters and my readers need to know if they're going to solve the mystery.
Well, that's what made it more interesting, because having not been to any of these places, and probably never will at the rate I'm going, it's nice to feel like you are there. And then the descriptions are so amazing that when you close your eyes, you could actually picture being there.
Oh, thank you. That's exactly what I'm trying to do, Fran, so thank you.
You see that? I got it.
You did. You get an A for the day.
Somebody said to me the other day, you always get what the book is about. Well, sometimes your book doesn't, I didn't have any problem getting it. I know I'm good. But as far as some, it takes a while in some of these historical fictions. And sometimes I just actually have to read the book a couple of times to get it. I usually do get it. But there's always like this hidden, I always try to find the hidden message in the book, or the hidden, I just finished Michael Bolton's book, The Soul of It, by the way, people, you want to read it, it was interesting. And I try to find the soul of what the author is trying to say. So, for those people that have
gone
never,
into, if you hadn't gone into Blog Talk Radio, Fran, you could have been an English teacher.
I'm a reading and writing staff developer. I work with children with learning disabilities.
Okay, background is being an English teacher, and we always look for the theme, we always look for the meaning behind there. And I think we never get over that if we've been trained in that, do we?
No, you know, my mom had Alzheimer's, and she passed away last year. So when she was diagnosed in 2003 with Alzheimer's, I had to retire, and at that point, I was becoming an overweight couch potato. Now I'm 109 pounds of not overweight anymore. And my sister, it's been horrible. My sister passed away almost 2 years ago. And it's weird. And she dared me to review my first book. So Martha Cheeves, I have to say, she writes the best cookbooks in the universe. And she dared me to read her book. She read my first children's book, except I don't cook. My husband does. So I had to come up with a clever way to showcase her writing. The recipes are phenomenal in Stir, Laugh, and Repeat. Her last two books are phenomenal. Think with Your Taste Buds Desserts, oh yeah. And Think with Your Taste Buds Beef. And Fran doesn't eat beef, so she autographed them to my husband, who does eat beef and cook. And the stories alone are hysterical. And my review was a riot, they tell me. Because I wrote it about Emory. They said it was the funniest thing they've read. So for anyone that hasn't been on a pilgrimage, I think Bethany, that Karen Vaughn is going to call in. Karen once in a while does the chat room so that I don't have to deal with it. And if she has any questions, you know, you never know what she's going to say. But that's okay. Tell everyone what a pilgrimage is and why any parents would send children on a specific pilgrimage. Well, this isn't a unique one, but explain that, because a lot of people don't know.
Well, a pilgrimage is a journey to a holy place. The act of pilgrimage has been central to most of the world's religions throughout history. And it comes really from the concept that all of life is a pilgrimage. That for the Christian, pilgrimage, a life is a pilgrimage to heaven. And, you know, whatever some other religion, you know, their life would be a pilgrimage to wherever their holy place is. But also, pilgrimage is seen as a means of grace, as a way of developing your own spirituality, finding the holiness within you, connecting with the holy person that that you're making pilgrimage to their place. And so this particular pilgrimage that Father Anthony is leading is a youth walk across, as I said, southern Wales. It's along a very ancient pilgrimage trail that pilgrims in medieval times walked this routinely, and this part of the trail has been opened up again. And they're still working on it. They're going to signpost it and make it even better. And these young people come on this. They come from many different backgrounds, different faiths. They are put in, you say, why would their parents send them? Well, in one mm-hmm. instance, even the school authorities sent this one young man because he was mm-hmm. such a problem to them. They thought, okay, this will be something good for you. Another young man who is about to take his exams in geology goes because he wants to get close to the formations of the earth and wants to explore that. So they come from all different reasons. And Father Anthony is leading this because one of his passions in life is to bring people of different faiths together. And he thinks if we can get the young people together, then we've made a huge step forward. And so this is an interfaith youth walk that he's leading.
Oh, wow. That is great. I know. But in between everything, it says, why so many prayers at each interval? I felt like I was praying sometimes, too. I actually repeated them.
Oh,
there were prayers
lovely.
That I never heard. It was. It really is good.
Well, there's really two reasons here. One, it's realism. It's a reflection of the youth walk that I went on. I walked 126 miles from London to the Shrine of Our Lady of Walsingham, because I wanted to, and also as background for this, because I needed to see how a real pilgrimage would be run, and this is the way it was done. But also, this is a reflection of life and of the proper way to write a novel, which mm-hmm. should be a reflection of life, because even if this is a thriller and you're being chased by murderers or you have shadows of evil chasing you, you can't run all the time. Mm-hmm. You have to have time, whether it's fiction or whether it's life, to sit down and to take stock and to look around, take a deep breath, and that's what these times of prayer allow you to do. Just to the American Indians had an expression when they would travel for a while, then they would spend a day not traveling. They wanted to let their soul catch up with them.
That,
and I always thought that was so beautiful. That's what our pilgrims are doing when they pause and pray and look around. They're letting their soul catch up with them.
I think more people need to do that. I think more kids need to do this.
Don't we?
Yeah, I really do.
Yeah, we do.
I think we need to take a breath and look around and just be happy with what we have.
Oh, exactly. Count our blessings. Smell the roses, truly.
I know. There was one of the books that I, like I said this before the show started, I read them. It's called Get a Grip, the Get Your Grip series, Get the Grip series by Derek O'Neill. And the first book they sent me, was six of them, was Happiness, and the other one was Anger. And after reading Anger this morning, I was able to deal with the phone company, my health care provider, and the internet provider the way I was told to in the book without getting too upset.
That is fantastic. Yes.
It was really great. Not only that, happiness teaches you that all the money in the world is not going to make you happy, all the material things, because eventually it'll be missing. And what about sitting in a mansion? I wrote in my last review, being by yourself and having nobody to enjoy life with. So we have lovely Felicity, who I love, but what is this haunting dream that keeps haunting her? And who is the person at the beginning that fell from the tower? And why did the police ignore him, ignore the whole thing?
Right. It is the book starts on the morning of the Feast of the Ascension, which was, according to the Bible, is when Christ, after Easter, after the resurrection, then was on earth for 40 days, and then he went up to heaven. So that's the ascension. So in order to symbolize this in this monastery where Felicity is, the students all go up to the top of the highest tower in the monastery and sing in the morning. And so they are all up there ringing bells and singing, and Felicity is overslept, so she didn't get to climb the tower with them. So she's standing down at the bottom, listening to them singing and waving to them, and everybody is just in a very celebratory mood. And then this body plummets over the tower, this black figure, because he's wearing a black cassock, and rolls to a stop at Felicity's feet. Well, he has a piece of paper in his hand. The hand falls open, and sort of without thinking, she reaches over and picks it up, and she gets a brief look at it, and then the paper bursts into flame. Besides the startling effect of the entire experience, she did get a quick enough look at the paper that she could see that it was a double-headed snake. It was some sort of a symbol or a diagram on the paper that included a double-headed snake. And this image stays with her. It comes back in her dreams, and then it comes back in reality as they are hiking through Wales, and she finds it on some posters and some other things there. And I don't want to tell too much about that.
No.
But the person then that did plummet over the tower, his name is Father Howell. He was a former student of Father Anthony's, and he is now a deliverance minister, which is a politically correct term, you might say, for an exorcist. And he is serving a parish in Wales. And just as a note of authenticity here, every bishop in the Church of England has an exorcist, or as they now say, deliverance minister, on his staff. We might think that the exorcist is just something from horror movies or something from the overheated brain of a fiction writer, and our brains do overheat occasionally. But this is a very valid, deeply spiritual calling that is used much today. So that was who Father Howell was, and that was
interesting.
That's why he, where he was coming from. You also asked them why the police ignore this.
Why didn't they?
They are convinced that Father Howell's plunge was a suicide. He had been having some problems, as they investigate and find this out. And they are convinced that this note that Felicity found in his hand, even though they don't have any explanation for why it burst into flame, and neither does she, they believe that that constituted a suicide note. And so they're not really looking into it any further than that.
That's really, I said, you know, this poor guy, and nobody's with, but I know Felicity, and she's not going to leave it, you know, let it go. I know that.
tries to, actually. She really wants to just have some quiet time and get away from dead bodies.
Yes, no
but,
fun.
It
no
doesn't
fun.
Work out that way.
No, because then that would kill the series, and that would just not be it, no. I mean, the fun
That's
part is
right.
that she's not. She's always going to be there. But you know what the great part about Felicity and Father Anthony is? Some characters, like some of the books that I've read, like, you know, I've read Murder, She Wrote a couple of times and a whole bunch. Sometimes the main character gets kind of annoying. And they, even though they're a detective, and they get kind of overactive, or they ask too many questions, or they butt in too much, she's just a rip and a half. So, you don't get bored with her. She doesn't, because any book that takes me more than a day to read, you're in trouble. Any book like yours and a few others that I read in the same day, you're not in trouble. And I know recently somebody asked me if I liked their book. I said it was interesting. And those are my exact words. So there's one kid that, I mean, most people might find obnoxious. I found him fascinating. Who is Colin, and he was like a teen guide to help the characters understand the history of the places. Now, of course, most kids would think he was in it. I thought he was great. So how come you included him? I thought he was really cool.
Well, first of all, I will have to say that he is based on one of the teens who was on the pilgrimage that I took, who, again, had his personal enthusiasm and talked about it nonstop. And I thought, well, you know, this is a good way to impart some knowledge. So I made Colin's particular enthusiasm to be the Romans, because we were walking through so much area where the Romans had lived and worked. And Colin is very bright. He's just socially awkward. And this was also important for the development of all of the pilgrims, because when you're on a pilgrimage, you're walking hundreds of miles, maybe 126 miles on the one that I walked. You're just close together. You're together whether a person is irritating or not, and you have to learn to accept this person and work with them. And so this was a development for all of the pilgrims to be able to learn to work with Colin. And then I was able to get in a lot of the Roman history and things that I wanted my characters to know. Colin knew it, and so he was spouting all of this off. And if they didn't turn him off, they really could learn something, because he's a very bright boy.
I learned a lot from just reading the book, let me tell you.
Oh, good.
Okay, we're going to bring in three new characters, and then I know Karen Vaughn is here. And Karen is in the chat room, so that Fran doesn't have to look at the chat room and sit and blink her eyes out here. Who are Evie, Chloe, and Kaylin? And they are quite interesting, to say the least.
Well, Evie, and first of all, they're all the characters that are on the pilgrimage, or eventually on the pilgrimage. Evie and Kaylin are young teenage girls, and they are goths. One of them is an illuminated goth, which means that she has red hair instead of the black hair. That was a fun term to learn. But because of this background, they are very receptive to occult influences. And this is good and this is bad. It makes them very receptive to the things in the landscape as they walk through, but also they can open themselves up to evil. And so they're very important characters because of that. Chloe comes in a little later. They meet her along the way. She is a young American tourist, and she joins the pilgrimage group to escape an unwanted relationship. Chloe is a photographer, and so her skills become very useful, particularly when she goes off with Felicity and they photograph some activities that are later very important in solving the crimes.
We're not going to tell anybody that, because it's really not, they have to read the book. I'm sorry.
That's right.
I mean,
absolutely.
For those of you
that
are listening,
I was going to say, we have a very mixed bag of pilgrims here. Lots of different types of people.
Yes, we do. And you know what? If the people that ran the government in the foreign countries were listening from all over the world, they might get along a whole lot better if they would, you know, read some of these books and understand that people are just who they are and that not everybody is the same. Karen, are you there? I know she's there.
Yes,
This is Karen Vaughn. She's there from Canada. You never know what Karen's going to say. Yes, and
hello.
Karen has two. Hi, Karen's got two questions, and I can email Adam and ask him if he'll send you the book, because she would like to read the book and review it too, and her reviews are really good, seriously, and she only writes nice
wonderful
ones too.
Thanks, Fran.
So, thank you. That's my thing on my site, reviewing your book. No nasty words, but you can write what you want. Okay, Karen, go ahead.
Okay, basically, I'm not a really spiritually minded person. I don't understand a lot of the Catholicism or religion around this book, the story. Do you really have to understand religion to get it?
Oh, I hope not, because I want all kinds of people to read my books.
Okay.
I think that it helps if you have an inquiring mind and are interested in the backgrounds of lots of different kinds of people, because that's what I try to bring in. And people that are alive today and people through history.
Okay. That sounds good. And is this a true thriller then, or is it considered a thriller?
The lines are so gray. The first book in the series was a Very Private Grave, was more of a thriller because the characters were trying to stop something from happening.
Okay.
Where in this one, they are more trying to figure out what has happened. And so that puts it a little more on the side of a mystery rather than a thriller.
Okay.
But it's a rather wobbly line. It's hard to say, really.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask what made you choose to write thrillers. Or
I like to have
of your books in the series a little bit different in that some lean more toward thrillers and others just mysteries like this one is?
Yes, exactly. I sort of go where the story takes me. I like to move around a lot. In one way, mine could be called cozy because they're clean. But I don't think of them as being cozies because we don't stay in one place and just try to solve one crime. Not your traditional Miss Marple, for example. My characters move around a great deal. In this case, they move all the way across southern Wales. In some other books, they've raced through northern England or up into Scotland, lots of different locations. So I like my characters to move around a lot. I like for a lot to happen. I like to give them plenty to work on.
Well, that's good.
Wait till you read this because you're going to need pencil and paper. And she writes a fantastic novel. And you will definitely not be bored. I can tell you something else. It keeps your mind active. By the time I remembered where I was going and whatever, sometimes I need a character map. And I said, okay, this one was tough. And then, of course, there's all the research in between, which is interesting. So you're in for a great read, Karen. What can I tell you?
Okay, great.
Wonderful.
Well,
thank you.
Who are the Morgans, and who do they fit? How do they fit into the story?
Ah, yes. Well, we come to the Morgans are some of the leading lights in the cathedral city of St. David's, which is where our pilgrims finally end up, out on the very, very tip of the western tip of Wales, in this beautiful little cathedral city. And as I say, Rhys Morgan is on the city council, and he has great plans for St. David's Cathedral and to redevelop some of the ruins there. His wife, Anne, runs a New Age healing shop in town, and they are key characters in the story. Is that enough to say?
we don't want to say too much of anything, because we don't want to give away too much information about anything. I know, no. But that's good. That's more than everybody needs, because those of you that are listening, you need to get the book. And we're not going to tell you where right now, but you can figure out where. Everywhere. And online and on Amazon. Okay, now, there was another character that I found very fascinating that we'll just sort of touch on but not tell everybody about. That was the driver who is Lydia? And the driver that seems so taken with Lydia.
Well, Michael is the driver, and he is there sort of, he's sort of Father Anthony's right-hand man in running the pilgrimage. Because this is just exactly as the pilgrimage that I undertook was run. You do have a vehicle to follow to carry some of your equipment with you, to meet you at stopping points to make tea. That's a pilgrimage runs on afternoon tea, I must tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's my favorite drink.
And then when anybody needs a break, they can ride in the van. And so that is what Michael is there for, helping with all of this. And Lydia is there as the nurse, which, again, this is just exactly like the pilgrimage that I undertook, because you do have twisted ankles. You have, every night we had a blister clinic that our nurse would set up. And Lydia is there to take care of all of that. She's also there to look over her little brother, Adam, who is not quite a teenager yet. He's young, and so he really wouldn't have been able to go on this if he hadn't had his older sister with him. And so she's there really for dual purposes.
I'm hearing extra voices now. I don't know why. Why did Felicity think, everywhere she went, poor Felicity, something bad happened? So why did she think that the pilgrim, that there was like a dark cloud following the pilgrims, and that somebody was trying to make sure that they never finished the pilgrimage?
Well, there were just so many inexplicable things that happened, things that kept going wrong. And when you have a group of teenagers walking across an ancient pilgrimage route, a certain amount of things going wrong, that's going to happen. You are prepared for some sprained ankles and for a few people wandering off and getting lost, or, you know, there will be things happen. There will be bad weather, particularly in Wales. This can come up very fast. But it goes beyond that. There's more. And there's also a sense of, well, maybe oppression, if that's not too strong a word, that comes up at times. And Felicity, who's very sensitive to these things, for all of her being rash and headstrong and some of the things we've talked about her being before, she also has a sensitivity to the spiritual life, and to spiritual things in the spirit world. That's what has drawn her to study in this monastery in the first place, besides the fact that she wanted to use her Latin. So she is sensing this.
Now, my nephew actually is taking Latin in high school. I don't know why he chose Latin over Spanish and French, but I guess he didn't want anybody to understand what he's saying.
So, well, you know, that's what our daughter did, our daughter that really is sort of the model for Felicity, and she has found it very useful. So,
my brother,
when I was in high school, we weren't offered that. They weren't teaching it then, but they're bringing it back now.
No, I was offered Spanish, French, or Hebrew. And I said to my mother, as an educator, I think I would need the Spanish. And she said, no, you're going to take French. And the one thing no one ever started with, my mother said French. It was French. She just didn't argue with the lady. And I was smart. I got the French medal and everything, but I just felt that Spanish probably would have been a whole lot easier and a whole lot more useful. And no, my mother said French. So when I got into college, she said, are you going to take more French? I said, no, I'm going to take Hebrew. Because I was fluent in it. And I said, there's no problem. And she said, no, I think you should take Spanish. I was hysterical. That didn't work. It didn't work. I said, you know what? What can I say? But, yeah, Latin would have been fun, because then no one would have understood what we were saying. But my brother and I would speak Hebrew in front of my mother and father. They had no clue what we were saying, and it was great. This way we could say whatever we wanted. That was even better. So, one of the places that you included in the book is the Bishop's Palace. Can you tell us more about it, the role, and what it is, so that people understand?
Oh, the Bishop's Palace is an amazing ruin, which is behind the Cathedral of St. David's. And first of all, I have to say that St. David's is probably the smallest cathedral in England, certainly one of the smallest. It's out on this tiny little strip of land in Wales, just right on the edge of the world, literally, or the edge of Great Britain. And then behind it was this amazing structure that was built by Bishop Henry Gower in the 14th century for his own use to entertain, because the bishops were the princes of the church in those days, and they entertained lavishly, had his own chaplain, actually there were two chapels in the bishop's palace, one for his private use and one for public worship, besides the cathedral that he's right next door to. This was ruined at the Reformation, or actually even a little before that, allowed to fall into ruin. But it's still there as an amazing structure. And part of this, we have Reese that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Who is a real estate developer, wants to bring the palace back up, kind of wants to rebuild it. And, it becomes the focus of a lot of the action of the story.
I don't want to get into too much more of the plot because I want these people, we have a lot of listeners all of a sudden. It's about time, people. You know, it's beautiful outside, but you could give us 2 hours and listen because Donna Fletcher Crowe's book on Holy Communion is definitely one that you want to read. What the great part is that I think teens and young adults could read them also.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
There's no inappropriate language, which makes it so much easier for me to read it. And, it's okay in a lot of books where it fits. But in this type of book, it definitely would not fit at all. I have a couple more questions, and I know Karen has a few, and then I know Mark Rubenstein just emailed me because I put him on the spot just now and asked him about if he would tell us more about what he does as a forensic psychiatrist and sort of related to what's going on in current events. Nothing like putting somebody on the spot. In an email, he said he would do it as long as we talk about the book, which is in front of me also. Okay, so. What's next for Felicity? What's your next one? And what is she going to be into with Father Anthony? I know they're going to get married.
Yes, everyone keeps saying, you know, when is the wedding? When is that coming up? But not yet. This one takes place at the end of June and early July, or end of May and into June. Mm-hmm. For an unholy communion. I do let them have a little bit of a rest, but now in A Muffled Tolling, which is book 4 in the series, it's late October. Felicity is off to visit some nuns again in Oxford. She has been asked to do some translation for a house of nuns, and this is... It's true, the Sisters of the Love of God in Oxford are well known for their publishing, and she has gone to assist with some Latin translation to help them with some publishing. And that's where she is, and things happen.
Things are going to happen, but I don't even have to ask you if in October I'm going to get the book, because as long as Adam is on it, I'll get the book before it even comes out. I know that. Karen, you have a couple of questions before Mark calls in?
Okay. My favorite question, if you did not write in your genre of either mystery or thriller, what would it be? Would you tackle something nonfiction, or would you tackle a romance?
Well, I started out as a romance writer, which is it's a great way to learn your trade. It was excellent training for me. I suddenly discovered I couldn't read them any longer. I just came to a point where I could not read another romance. And if you cannot read in a genre, then you cannot write in it. Mm. So then I went to writing more just straight historical novels. And I have quite a few of those out. Anyone's welcome to visit my website at www.donnafletchercrowe.com. And you can see my backlist there. But then I started wanting a little more action, and so that's why I went into mystery writing. I suppose if I didn't write mysteries, I would go back to the straight history then. Not nonfiction. I had a little flirtation with writing nonfiction, but it didn't really take hold for me. So I think I will stay with the novel form, but I might go back just to a straight historical novel then.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Now, I think, let's see. Donna, would you tell everybody where we can find your books, too?
Yes. As I say, www.donnafletchercrow.com. Everything is on my website. And, of course, everything is on Amazon. And you could simply Google the Monastery Murders, and everything will come up. So lots of places, fine bookstores anywhere should have them. I know Barnes & Noble should be carrying them.
Well, the next time I go in there, if I don't see it, I'm going to tell them.
Please
that it should be there. I do, because you know what? Sometimes I'll review books, and I know that they're in the bookstores, and I'll walk in and I'll say, oh, gee, you know, where is Roger Ellery's book? Where is Donna Fletcher Crowe? Why aren't they on the shelves? The author said the book is on the bookshelves now. Why don't you have it? They put certain books in the front, you know, as bestsellers, but that doesn't mean that those are the best ones. And just because a book is on the New York Times bestseller list, people, does not mean that it's a great book. It just means that the person sold a lot. It doesn't mean that I'm going to give it 5 stars. And I've read a whole bunch of New York Times bestseller books, seriously, and I have not given every one of them 5 stars. I mean, before I forget, I need to say my picks of the month, or they're going to think that I forgot, and I don't want to forget. The Secrets They Kept by Suzanne Handler is a book about a man named Sam Levin who decided to take the life of his 16-year-old daughter, Sally, when she was 16, because she had schizophrenia. The sad part is that the family took a secret pact, and nobody knew about her until she was told about her by an aunt. And it was really one of the most compelling memoirs and stories that I've read in a long time. Believe it or not, people, I read a book yesterday in Zap Time again, Divorce, Think Financially, Not Emotionally, by Jeffrey A. Handler. Girls out there, for those of you that are going through divorce, or even for young people that are thinking about getting married, after you read this book and find out what it entails and what you go through, you're going to think twice. And you're going to say, well, maybe I need to be over 19 or 20 to get married. Maybe I need to think about what will happen if it doesn't work out. The book is really interesting. And for me to say that, it's really great. And then I read by Derek O'Neill, Happiness is book one, and Anger is book two. And dealing with the phone company and the other companies today, and the internet company, after reading Anger, I was really good, and I did not get upset. And I let the anger go, and I dealt with the problem and got my problem solved. So thank you, Derek O'Neill, for sending me the book. And Happiness is really great. And the other one is How to Create a Good Life and from a Real Life by Primrose Roberts, who is really, 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 really good. Okay. Karen, that would have been nice, right? But I read self-help books, and then I wonder sometimes, like, oh my God, I don't know about this. And these two happen to be really good, and I've got a few more. Okay, so from reading your book, Donna, what lessons do you hope people will get and come away with? And if teens were reading it, what do you hope they'll gain from reading your book?
Well, I want my readers to have an appreciation of our heritage. This would be particularly those from the Christian heritage, but also anyone living in America or England, in the Western world, because the historical people that I develop in the backgrounds, these are people that have helped bring us to where we are today. And I think that the things that the holy men and women of the past have lived for and have died for, the lessons that they have learned, they do impinge on the present. It's just we might not be as aware of them, but we need to hear what they have to say, because they can help us with our problems today.
I agree, definitely. And, not enough people understand the definition of kindness and how to get along and things. What do you think, if the characters in your book, the kids in your book, what do you think they would say that they learned from going on this pilgrimage. We're not going to tell anybody what happened at the end. But what do you think the characters would have learned about friendship and loyalty as a result of going on this trip?
Well, one of the first things would be working together, because of the importance of cooperation. I think in America sometimes we teach our children so much they need to stand on their own two feet, they need to think for themselves, they need to be able to, mm-hmm. you know, to act alone. And then there is some truth of that, but we also need to be able to work together as a community. And this mm-hmm. pilgrimage is really an exercise in community, because when one person falls off the edge of a coal tip, as there are a great many of them in Wales, and this does happen, mm-hmm. then they have to band together, they have to work together to help this person, and it affects everybody. And it goes this way all the way through everything, that they are only as strong as they can work together. And this is an important lesson for us all to learn. And then, as I've said before, an appreciation of our heritage, because the lessons of the past, if we don't learn from the mistakes that were made in the past, we'll have to make the mistakes again, because there are lessons there to be learned.
Well, I learned a lot reading the book, but there's one generic question that I haven't asked.
Okay.
When you use a character in a series, now Felicity is definitely not boring, and she changes and grows from each story to each story, correct? In order to keep the specific techniques to keep the plot on track, how hard is it to decide what Felicity is going to do from novel to novel in order to keep people coming back and saying, I can't wait to see what she's going to get into next?
Well, I've said many times that I think one of the fun things of this series is growing Felicity up. Because she has so many good qualities, with her strength of will, her energy. She's very, very intelligent, and there was just no stopping her for something that she believes is the right course of action. But she is also very rash, very headstrong, will rush ahead without thinking. And so she needs to develop her strengths and cut back a little bit on some of the bullheadedness. And so each situation that I give her a new problem to work with in each novel, I want to see her grow. Anthony is sort of the flip side of the coin to her. He is so tied down, so internal. He needs to express himself more. He needs to learn from her to cut loose and be a little rash sometime. Take a chance on something. And I think my characters are learning from each other. They both started out with problems, and they don't solve those problems in a day. But I'm hoping that by the time we get up with book five, they will be their wedding. I don't mind telling that ahead, because everybody wants to know, when are these two people going to get married? And it will happen in book five. They have maturing that needs to be done. They need to grow within themselves before they come together as a married couple. I think that's very, very important. You were talking about young readers learning from this divorce mm-hmm. novel, divorce self-help book that you reviewed.
Yeah.
I believe, you know, we can learn from novels too, and I believe it's important that each person be strong within themselves before they come to a wedding, to their marriage. So that's what I'm hoping for Anthony and Felicity. I'm edging them this way.
You're doing a good job, and I want to thank you so very, very much. And I know
thank
that
you.
The next book is coming out in October, which means that Adam will probably send it to me in August or September. And, of course,
no,
we'll
it won't.
Another interview.
What? My deadline to have it written is in October, but it won't be published that soon. I'm sorry, Fran.
Oh, I have to wait to find out. Okay, but don't worry. I will make time for you for another interview whenever the book comes out.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you. I would love to come back.
Thank you so very much, Donna. And Karen, I just emailed Adam, and I'm hoping that I'll hear back from him so I could put you in an email and you can get the book.
Okay.
Thank you. And I would like to introduce my next guest. Oh, I am so excited. He's back finally to talk about his book because he's been on a couple of shows, but he hasn't been able to speak about his book alone. Mad Dog House is really one of my favorite. Mark, would you call it a psychological thriller or just scary?
I think most people would say it's a thriller, and it is a psychological thriller, but of course certain things happen beyond the internal psychology of the protagonist that, you know, some people have said it's plot-driven and character-driven, but it's certainly psychological and has a good deal of psychology about a number of things in it.
It's scary, too, and I have to tell everybody that I got lucky. Well, your next book's coming out in September, but I'm halfway through it. That's all I'm going to say. And Love Gone Mad, whoa, let me tell you. Poor Megan, oh my goodness. If I wasn't scared before when I read Mad Dog House, this one is really, I'm stalling reading it, finishing it, because it's so good that I don't want to finish it yet.
Oh, thank you.
I'm serious, that's how good it is, that usually I would finish it in a day, and I read like three books in between, and I'm saying, oh my God, this one is really, really scary. So, Mark, could you explain to everyone, because we didn't get a chance to last time, what a forensic psychiatrist does? Because I have tons of questions for your books, and then we're going to talk a little current events at the end of the show, people.
Okay. Well, I'm a psychiatrist. I'm a physician and a psychiatrist, and early in my psychiatric career, I got involved in forensic psychiatry. Forensic psychiatry is really the application of psychiatry to the law, and it can be criminal law or civil law, and a forensic psychiatrist is often called in to make clinical judgments about various things in both civil and criminal cases. For instance, the issue of competency to draw a will, that's known as testamentary capacity, the issue of damages in a civil lawsuit where, let's say, somebody has gone through a trauma such as rape or assault and a civil suit has been filed, and the attorneys want to know what kind of psychiatric or psychological damages or issues evolved from that. There is also, of course, the well-known situation of criminals occasionally pleading not guilty by reason of insanity, and we see some of that in the Jodi Arias case, although she certainly has pled guilty and is using that sometimes people refer to as an excuse defense, you know. But it is the application of psychiatry to the court system and courtrooms in general and evaluating cases.
Well, I would be interested to know. We're going to talk about Roddy, and we're going to talk about Kenny, and we're going to talk about Daniel, the three characters in this book. But I would be curious to know how, as a forensic psychiatrist, you would analyze these three.
Oh, boy. Well, I'd have to, I think, Fran, I'd have to analyze myself because they really all derive from my own imaginings. Although, you know, to some extent, I suppose, as is the case with every novelist, there are certain autobiographical elements in it. I was in the Army, and I came from Brooklyn, New York, which is where Roddy comes from. Roddy,
oh, my dad, too.
Dolan. Oh, okay. And
Williamsburg?
I never got in trouble with the law, but I did go into the Army, and when I was attached to the 82nd Airborne, I became a field medic and tended to injured paratroopers, and as a consequence, I have a degree in business administration of all things, but I went back to college after the Army, and fortunately got into medical school, became a physician, and then went into psychiatry. So there are certain parallels, if you will, between Roddy and me, as well as parallels, I guess, with any character any writer ever creates or constructs, because after all, they do come from within. mixing in and kind of mix and match, you know, your own experiences, your fantasies, your friends, your background. It all comes down through the mix master.
Well, I'm glad you're not more like Kenny, but that would not be good.
So am I.
But Danny, you know, he's an experienced, too, as an accountant. But they were in high school and they all got in trouble. I don't want to say too much about them. Yeah, they got in trouble.
Yeah.
And how come they didn't wind up in prison?
Well, it's funny. Mad Dog House is both a simple story,
yeah,
and on some level it's a complicated story. If I can just give a very brief synopsis,
go ahead.
Just
yeah,
so that
do that.
The audience can get a sense of, you know, where we're going. Mad Dog House is about a suburban surgeon living north of New York City, a fellow named Roddy Dolan, who had a very checkered past. Almost landed in jail at age 17, but didn't because of an understanding judge and because a dear friend of his, the friend's mother, intervened and got his teachers to write letters and tell the judge what a great kid he was and how bright he was. And Roddy gets sentenced to 3 years in the Army, and he becomes a paratrooper and a ranger and learns field surgery and decides to go to college, and he becomes a physician and specifically a surgeon. Well, in the middle of his life, at about 44 years of age, along comes one Kenny Egan, whose nickname as a kid was Snake Eyes, because he gambled so much. And Ken Egan has changed dramatically, or so it would appear, and he offers Roddy, along with his best friend Danny Burns, who's now an accountant living in Tuckahoe, New York, an opportunity to become silent partners in a Manhattan steakhouse. And that's where the trouble really begins, because there are mafia honchos and Russian thugs hanging around, and the lives that Roddy and Danny knew abruptly come to an end at some point fairly early in the book, and the rest of the book deals with, you know, what are they going to do here? They're in a very bad situation, and so that's where we're at. And to answer your question before, you know, how come he didn't go to jail? He was lucky. He had Dan Burns's mother, Peggy Burns, who always called him, along with Danny, a best boy, Peggy's best boys, and thought that he had a lot of potential and got the teachers to write letters to the judge. And the judge, in his own way, took pity on Roddy and realized he was only 17 and gave him a chance to do 3 years in the Army as opposed to 2 years in a penal institution. And that really turned Roddy's life around.
Well, at least for then it did, because later, whatever. he believed he changed. But one of my questions on my paper that I didn't get to ask you last time is, can you really hide from your past? And Kenny imposes this thing to them to go into business. And knowing his background, we won't say what it is, what safeguard should have been in place before they said, oh, yeah, no problem? And what made them decide to say, oh, yeah, we're going to go into this? How come they just did it?
Well, they did it because, first of all, Danny Burns was very, very keen on the idea because it appealed to a certain element in his own psychology. I will tell you, there is a sequel coming after Love Gone Mad.
Oh, good.
And that'll be
explicated
a little bit. Yeah. I realize there was some unfinished business too many readers asked for sequels and didn't want me to close the book, so to speak, on Roddy and Danny. But there were certain issues in Danny's life that led him to want to take a chance and to get into the glamour and glitz of a New York steakhouse. In addition, you know, they did check out, I should say Danny really checked out Kenny's background. He had been in Las Vegas, had managed the restaurant at the Bellagio, and was a fairly stand-up guy, or so the records would appear. He did a thorough search on him for any bankruptcy filings, and he checked with Experian and Equifax, you know, the credit companies, and called a few people, but it didn't seem to be enough because Kenny was apparently not as straightforward with Danny and Roddy as he could have been. But they did go into business with him as silent partners, meaning that they wouldn't really have any active role in the restaurant itself, but rather would just be backers and would hopefully reap profits. Roddy was reluctant to do so from the very outset, but he figured he'd go along with his best friend and Kemosabe, as they called each other, Danny, because Danny really was a certified financial planner and knows the world. Boy, what a mistake that was.
I know, because he didn't do his... One did his homework, and the other one should have done a little bit more homework.
A little bit more, yeah. But, you know, we're all trapped by our psychologies. We're all trapped, so to speak, by our needs and sometimes by who we'd like to be. And Danny wanted to be what he wasn't. He found doing the work of a CPA to be kind of dull and pedestrian. And, boy, he just couldn't resist the glitz and the glamour of a New York steakhouse. He could be there with the Donald Trumps and the Pete Hamels and all the movers and shakers. And he sort of fancied himself as, you know, one of these great impresarios of a really popular restaurant in Midtown, and things turned out differently, but that was part of what led them to go where they went.
Yeah, I know. That's what's really scary about this book. When I got the book, I'm looking at it, I'm going like, okay, what is this about? And then I read the back cover, and I said, okay, now what is this about? And I started to read it, and then, of course, I had to turn all the lights on. Karen was just saying she had to do the same thing when, you know, if you read a scary book, and after I read it, I said to my husband, you're not going anywhere tomorrow, because I just, you know, this book was so scary. It took me, usually it takes me like no time to read a book, and I was like, every time I started to read it, going, do I really want to read this? It's scary. It was really good, but it was really scary. I mean, and in between there, you meet Ronnie, we meet his wife, who seems to be the only normal person there. And then we meet his son, Tommy, and then we meet Stacy, the poor thing. She's stuck in the middle of this mess. Now, I don't want to say the name of the partner, you know, that they go into, because we don't want to tell everybody about him, because, you know, they have to find out who the bad guy is by themselves. But his son, Roddy did a whole bunch of bad things when he was a kid, and all of a sudden his son seems to be mirroring his behavior.
Like father, like son, yes.
Yeah, that's what... Well, we're going to talk about something else at the end after I'm done with the questions, which, you know, brings up another person that's kind of young and in big, fat trouble. So tell everybody about Tommy and why his behavior mirrors his father as a child, as a young guy.
Well, there are a few reasons, but just for a second, to get back to the scary issue, you know what?
I'm scared.
I always find the scariest things are not the Stephen King kind of supernatural stuff, but the things that could really actually happen to you or me, or for that matter to anybody. That to me takes on the scariest implications, because, you know, supernatural, I mean, it can be quite scary, but after all, it's so far out. Whereas what happens with Roddy and Danny could happen to anybody who just makes some bad choices. To get back to Tommy, you know, Roddy worries about Tommy that Tommy has a genetic disposition, or if you will, a predisposition to being like he did, like he was, ending up as a dead ender, as Roddy conceptualized it. On the other hand, you know, the kid is 12 years old and he's living in an affluent suburb. And, you know, kids today at 12 and even younger, sad to say, many of them are drinking and they're going online and they're getting into trouble, not in major ways, not committing felonies, but they're so precociously endowed with information because of the Internet and just the way our culture has morphed over the last, whatever, 20, 30, 40 years, that it's enough to worry any parent. And I don't think that Tom in the book is terribly abnormal or headed necessarily for trouble, though it certainly appears that he could be. But it is worrisome to Tracy, that is Roddy's wife, and certainly to Roddy himself. But, of course, Roddy has enough trouble. Once the restaurant gets into gear, he has enough trouble to deal with at that point. But I don't see Tom as being quite as pathologic as he might turn out to be. Simply because of the culture we live in and because of the influences kids have today with computer-generated imagery and the violence in movies today. And, it's a whole nother world. I mean, I think back to when I was a kid, it was so tame. it was just a whole different world. So I tried to capture some of that, you know, the kid's not listening to his father, he's listening to his iPod, and he says, yeah, whatever. Yeah, you know, the typical...
Sounds like my 13-year-old nephew, yeah, he does that. He's not fresh, but he'll look at you and go, like, whatever. Wouldn't say it to me, he'll say it to somebody else, though.
Yeah, whatever.
He knows
that's
better. That's the biggest insult in the world when somebody says whatever.
That's right.
That's what I was told by my teenage nephew, is not... Or
not,
later.
Or whatever. Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, I learned because if they call me at 11 o'clock at night to say, you know, can you help me with my essay? I go, like, where were you 2 hours ago? I was doing this. I go, whatever. You get to do it yourself. No, I do it anyway.
Of course. But yes, whatever is the ultimate dismissal of another human being in its own way.
Yeah, it is.
Way.
Or talk to the hand.
It's so dismissive, and it's so I don't care. I just don't. I give a damn.
I know.
And you know, Roddy has to deal with this, and he does find within himself, Roddy, a capacity for empathy and understanding and tolerance with Tom. He even says to Tom, "Look, Tom, there are consequences to everything you do in your life. When you have a question about anything, whether it's right or wrong or you should do it or not, listen to that little voice in your head because it'll tell you the right thing to do." So Roddy knows about conscience. He knows there's this little fellow sitting on his shoulder who will tell him you did wrong or you're doing wrong, and he hopes that his son has the same. But I'm a little more optimistic about Tom right now than
that depends on what you write.
It depends on what happens in the
next
sequel.
Book.
Yeah.
Well, I know that kids don't realize that Facebook and Twitter, you know, that's your resume, people. I just did a book on divorce, and those women out there that are getting divorced, you don't want to put anything bad on Facebook because judges do look at Facebook accounts and Twitter, according to the book that I read. So you don't want to get caught in that kind of a trap either.
So you have to be careful. Yeah, you do, Fran. I will tell you that as a forensic psychiatrist and being asked to evaluate a plaintiff in a case, either at the request of a plaintiff's attorney or a defendant's attorney, part of the data that's submitted to me in many instances has been Facebook pages, Twitter streams, along with medical records, psychiatric records, psychiatric reports, psychology tests, and so forth. So, yes, there is an indelible record that, and it's one that's self-created and sometimes is overly revealing, and many people don't really appreciate the degree to which they compromise their own privacy when they say certain things on Facebook or Twitter, or even in emails.
Well, there's also people dig, because I post on Dig and Friend Feed, but I learned a long time ago the only thing that you're going to see Fran post are her book reviews and the links to my show. That's it. And maybe once in a blue moon I may say happy birthday. I don't post anything ever because you don't know when it's going to come back and haunt you, and that's the one thing that you don't want. So let's see. We've got Roddy. We've got Kenny. And as a forensic psychiatrist, where would you put Kenny's behavior? How would you describe him? He's different than the other two.
Kenny was a product of his upbringing in Brooklyn. I don't really get terribly deeply into his home life, but he was, as we used to say when I was a kid, he was a rotten kid, okay? Just a rotten kid. And he had a very checkered past, and he went where people who love to gamble go, namely Las Vegas, and he spent many years in Las Vegas. Where would I put him? I would say you'd have to consider him somewhere on the spectrum of a sociopath, a fellow who lacks conscience and who will just do whatever he can to get what he wants and doesn't really consider the consequences or the impact it might have on other people. He's probably the easiest one to label or affix, a semi-diagnosis to. Roddy and Danny, at least for me, are more complicated than that.
Yeah, I agree with you. So tell everybody a little bit about the sweetest character in the book and what upsets Stacy. She's so sweet. She's more me because I was perfect as a child. I never got in trouble. So boring. Now I made up for it, they tell me.
Well, Stacy is Roddy's wife, and she's a smart...
Oh, I meant the little girl, the daughter.
I'm pulling a senior, Sandy. Yes, Sandy.
Sandy.
She's a delightful 10-year-old girl who's smart and pretty and who adores her father and who does wonderfully in school and is on the soccer team and has lots of friends and wants to become a doctor like her father and probably will. And she's a wonderful kid and very expressive of the way she feels and she and Tracy, his wife, are the lights of Roddy's life. I mean, they really, for him, everything is contained at home. Not so much with Tom, but with his daughter Sandy and his wife Tracy. They are the lights of his life.
Well, let's see what happens. I wonder what would happen if his wife found out what he was really doing.
That's a good question because Danny and Roddy find themselves in a position at some point. Of course, I don't want to reveal too much, but they do find
themselves.
I'm sorry?
We can't tell them the good part.
No. they find themselves in a position where they can not reveal anything about what's going on, and. This comes to weigh heavily on Roddy, and he's in a terrible bind. As is Danny. They are caught in a web, partly of their own making, but partly also simply of circumstances about which they knew nothing. And not only do they have to try and get out of the web, but they have to try and keep it all a secret. And that could be difficult to do because, they are in such deep water that it's hard for them to, I mean, you know, Roddy's not sleeping and in the sequel, you'll see what happens.
When am I getting this sequel? I just have to make sure that all the lights in my house are on and it's not going to be dark outside.
Well, as you know, the next one is not a sequel to Mad Dog House. The next one is Love Gone Mad, and it's
is so good.
Yeah, there's totally different characters and mm-hmm. so forth. But the sequel to Mad Dog House is called Mad Dog Justice, and that'll be coming out probably 10 or 11 months after Love Gone Mad comes out. So we're now, two, three books down the line. Yeah. I've just finished off Mad Dog Justice, and I know some of what I know what happens. I know all of what happens, but I don't want to tell.
I'll find out because I know your publicist, and she thinks I'm wonderful. So I know the minute she gets a copy, Tracy's going to send me one because that's how I got Mad Dog House. I had no idea I was getting it. And it just wound up. Yeah, it just wound up, in my mailbox. And I'm like, what is this book? And it's, if I don't know the author, if I'm not really sure, even the self-help books, I may stare at them for a week or two, and then all of a sudden I go like, oh, okay. But Love Gone Mad is right next to me. It's left to my left hand. And I've read 142 pages, and I won't tell you where the girl character is right now. And I'm going to make sure I leave the lights on the next time I go in the elevator and wherever else. This is if I thought it was scary before, oh, my God. I do hope this turns out to be a fairly happy ending, or I'm going to be very upset. But that's beside the point.
I can't tell you.
No, don't tell me because you can't ruin that for me, no.
I should mention, by the way, why is it called Mad Dog House, getting back
to... I was going
to
ask you that, too.
Yeah.
Yes, why?
Well, Roddy's nickname as a kid was Mad Dog because when he got really, really angry, he fought like a mad dog, and he was known... His street moniker was Mad Dog, and one of the questions that really the book raises, not only can you outrun your past or leave your past behind you, but can you revivify your past if need be, and could he call upon that mad dog again in order to get himself out of this horrendous situation? And it's called Mad Dog House because it's about Roddy Dolan, the mad dog, and it's about Roddy Dolan's life now in Bronxville, New York, in suburbia, and the house he lives in, and so forth. And I sort of like the play of where Mad Dog and Dog House, you know, it all kind of goes along. And
you put him almost in my neighborhood, so you scared me even more.
Uh-huh.
I'm not in Bronxville. My cousin lives in Bronxville, and I told her about the book, and I said, you better, you know, lock your door real fast because you never know who's going to come and visit. So I scared her a lot, and that was fun, too, because that is so much fun to scare somebody who gets scared so easily. You know? Okay, I have some other kinds of questions, which I added this morning, and I have a few other questions. Tommy was difficult, but Tracy and Roddy didn't see the signs that would alert them. And I'm not going to tell anybody what the ending of the book is. So where do you see Tommy going with his behavior? Because that last scene really scared me even more. I'm saying, like, oh, my God, this kid is really going to do this. So is he going to turn out to be like his father, or is he going to turn out to be worse?
Well, we don't know, and I can't say I really know exactly what's going to happen. A good deal of, as I said before, a good deal of Tommy's behavior really reflects the change in our culture more than any specific pathology in relation to Tommy. He is a troubled kid in some respects, and we don't really know why, per se. You know, you can just go into so much in any one novel unless you want to write War and Peace. So I really don't know... quite, you know, what's troubling him other than the usual early adolescent angst that we see so often. But, you know, I do hold a good deal. I'm talking about these people like they're real, you know. I was going to say...
That's what makes it better, is because you make it sound as if they're real.
I do hold out hope for Tom. I think he'll probably turn out okay. All things... considered down the line, but we have to find out. That's a couple of books away.
We don't know how Roddy and Danny are going to turn out either. So is Mad Dog Justice the end, or is there going to be more? Is it going to be a whole bunch?
Mad Dog
people?
I think I'm going to put them to rest at the end of Mad Dog Justice. But then again, I had no idea that I wrote Mad Dog House as a standalone novel. I had no idea that I'd write a sequel, none whatsoever. Yet so many people contacted me or reviewed the book,
and I said it. Yeah, that was one of at the end of my book. Yeah, under my review, I said you have to write another one.
That was what so many people said, that I said, you know, is there a sequel here? I certainly viewed it as a good sign that people wanted a sequel and so forth. And I didn't realize the extent to which I left certain business unfinished, that there was definitely unfinished business at the end and very rich fodder for a sequel. So the sequel is, it's written. It's written. It's coming.
That's good. And Karen, in case you're listening, I just got an email from a Mark's publicist, and I put you in an email. You're going to get a copy of the book to read. So you've got another reviewer to read this also. I have a really strange question, and then we're going to switch gears because I'm curious to know what you take. I read the article, by the way, from Huffington Post that you emailed me based on what happened last week. I read everything you send me. I just want everybody to know. I do my research, people, and I read it. What would have happened if Tommy's sibling was not a sister, was another brother? How would that have changed the complexion of what happened between them?
Well,
if it was a guy, if it was a boy.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There could have been a lot of competition. There could have been a great deal of friction there. I mean, I'd have to think about that. We would see siblings. The relationship between and among siblings is always very complicated. Years ago, I did a book for the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center called The Growing Years, which was a guide to children's emotional development. And there was a separate chapter on sibling rivalry. And depending on the order in which any particular kid is, and depending on the genders and a lot of other variables, you can have all kinds of relationships between and among siblings. Mm-hmm. So it's tough to really say, but I think it's probably better for all concerned that along came Sandy, a delightful little girl. Yeah. I think two boys in the house could have been very problematic for Roddy and Tracy, and also for both boys.
That would have been interesting, though.
Probably
me even more. Yeah.
What
are parents today, teens? I just came from my brother's. He has three. One's going to be 18. One is going to be 16, and one was 13. And
He's in the thick of it. Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the thick of it. The only person, I have to be honest, they're great, because the one person they're never rude to is, guess who, over here, me.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a million years. And they're not rude to their parents, except, when they have to be, what can I say? That's just kids. But and they're all A students, so they know that they can, drive their aunt crazy and call me at 8, 9 o'clock at night and say, could we talk about an essay that I have to write? Did you read the book? In case you didn't, you can download it. I don't read on my computer because I have, my eyes start to bug out. So I said to them, can you give me the short version or whatever? So why should parents pay closer attention to teens whose behaviors, I taught for 36 years in the public school system as a reading and writing staff developer, and I was a dean. So if you have a student that's usually, and we did have kids that were perfect, you never got in trouble, and all of a sudden something happens that is not right, and you can see this really good kid gets in trouble, you're not going to, come down on him. You're going to find out why. So why should parents pay closer attention to teens whose behaviors are deviant or they might harm themselves or something? What are the warning signs that tell parents you better pay closer attention to your kids and stop going to the club or out during the week or wherever?
Yeah, any change in behavior that seems out of character for a kid is something that could potentially set off an alarm, certainly raise a parent's antenna. I'm thinking, among other things, of, let's say, a kid like Adam Lanza, the Newtown disaster. Kind of aberrant behavior, withdrawal, inability to either no longer wanting to go to school or a sudden drop in grades. I think the big problem these days, one of them anyway, it's very complicated, is that parents are very, very busy. Many, many parents are both working in today's economy, and we used to call them latchkey kids, but today I don't know if they even have that phrase anymore. It sounds outmoded to me. But, parents really should know what their kids are doing. They should know who their friends are. They should meet their friends. Parents should also know what sites their kids go to on the Internet, I think it's tough to do sometimes because everybody's so busy, and many parents may not be so tech savvy. They may not even have the means at their disposal to really keep up with the technology of kids today with smartphones and the iPads and whatever. So I think the bottom line is basically parents have to really stay on top of what's going on with their children. Any change, they have to really sit down and talk frankly with the kids, and by no means is that a guarantee that things will work out well. There's always the question of intervening, and when and how do you intervene? It depends, of course, on what's going on. If there's something that seems to be serious, as in the book with Tom, where he's drinking and he hot wires a car in a parking lot and so forth, that really probably calls for some kind of real proactive intervention on the parents' part. And there's no hard and fast rule. You just have to really stay on top of it and know what your kids are up to.
Well, you need to monitor. I know my brother does, and he's never been tech savvy. I informed him what he has to do, and my niece does also. They know what's on their Facebook walls. They know what they're saying. They know who their friends are. If there's a problem, my niece doesn't hesitate to go on my niece's wall and unfriend somebody for her, or let him know. We saw a couple of things that I didn't like on one of my niece's walls, and I took care of it with somebody that works with law enforcement because I said this is inappropriate, and I don't like what's happening. Parents need to know that Twitter, Facebook are like you said, it's their resumes for when they get older, and they don't realize that they're hurting themselves. Now, my question to you about the book, and then we're going to change gears in a minute, is do you think that Tommy's behavior will ever spill over to Sandy?
I don't think so. They're very different characters. They're separated by 4 years. She's really into a certain mode of functioning she's idealized her father. She wants to be like him. She asks him to help her. They have to draw a diagram of the human heart. And, of course, he's a surgeon, so he's going to bring home a model that he has in the office. I mean, it's a whole different relationship. I don't think she's going to go down that path. Although, you know, when kids get to be 14, 15, 16 and older, you never know what's going to happen.
Well, that is so true. But if they were living in my house with my mother, they would be perfect. My mother literally knew where I was going, and I have to tell you, to teens, the smartest thing that my mom ever did was, and she wouldn't give me a cell phone at all. She wouldn't let me have anything like that. But she knew where I was going. If I was going to a friend's house, I had to call her when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I walked home by myself. I lived in the South Bronx. Wasn't exactly safe. And of course, made sure I had money for a payphone or something to get home. But kids today need to call their parents wherever they go. And if you have your cell phone, you need to leave it on because in case you get in trouble, you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So those people that think that their parents are checking up on them or spying on them, it's called keeping you alive and safe.
And out of harm's way.
So
what's your enough of that.
I know, there's not enough of that. And kids all of a sudden think, oh, he's spying on me. They can't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
Actually, they can tell you what to do because they have the control over your allowance and stuff like that in your life. And A's in school are really good to get. I know that because those are the only ones I was allowed to get. And school is important because it's your power to get where you want to go when you get older. And
school
it gives
your
you
job.
The freedom to make choice. Yeah, and that's your job, and it gets you where you want to go. And, I learned a long time ago, it gives you the opportunity to have the choices that you want. Without it, you don't have those choices.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of limited. So this, I read your article on the Boston Marathon on Huffington Post. You want to tell everybody about that? It was interesting, I have to tell you.
Yeah, well, you know, we were all impacted by the traumatic event at the Boston Marathon. As a psychiatrist, I felt that I certainly wanted to talk a little bit about getting beyond the name of the article is After Boston, and I was really looking to trying to advise people as to, you know, how to put this kind of a thing in perspective. I also wanted to define a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder, what it is and what it is not. Jodi Arias does not have post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an excuse defense. There are no doubt some people who are within the zone of danger right there on Boylston Street in Boston who saw people get killed or lose a leg or get terribly injured and maimed or who themselves were injured and maimed, who will develop post-traumatic stress disorder, and I wanted to define that just a little bit. But I wanted to talk about how to cope with and get beyond this kind of senseless act, or no matter what the rationalization was on the part of the perpetrators. And I said, among other things, that we have to understand and accept the fact that we live in a dangerous world, that terrorism is in fact an ongoing phenomenon in Europe, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, really all over the world, and it has come here too, certainly perhaps not as dramatically as in other places, at least not yet, although certainly there's very little that was as dramatic as the 9/11 attacks. By the way, I evaluated, was involved with evaluations, recommendations, and treatment with over 300 of the survivors of the
Wow.
World Trade Center. Over 10 years, I saw over 300 of them. In any event, it's a worldwide phenomenon, terrorism, and there will always be terror to one extent or another, given today's technology, and we can't deny that. We have to accept that as a reality. I also wanted to point out the fact that in the grand scheme of things, the likelihood that any one of us will be the victim of a terror incident is far less than the chance of being injured or killed walking across a busy city street or walking past a construction site or driving a car or being driven in a car. On a statistical basis, it's certainly less dangerous. I also wanted to point out that terror and terrorism is a way that people with a certain kind of pathologic agenda try to do exactly that. They try to terrorize us and make us reluctant to live our ordinary lives. We, you know, don't go to a theater, don't go to a sporting event, don't go to a parade, don't ride on a train or an airplane or whatever. And if we succumb to that kind of terroristic fear, then we become diminished and we are lessened. We become less by virtue of the terrorist's actions, and that's really the absolute wrong response to terrorism, and we really cannot afford to allow that to happen to us. So kudos to the people of Boston and for celebrating the fact that Boylston Street is back in business. Yes, there was a tragedy. 3 people died, scores were injured, and the whole city was in lockdown for a couple of days, and in a sense the entire city was traumatized. That's just part of the world in which we live, and we have to keep going. So for those who really suffer from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, there are treatments available, they can be very successful, although in some instances there are people who go for years and years. I've got to tell you, I occasionally see someone with real smoldering post-traumatic stress disorder deriving from Vietnam in 1968.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be a lifelong affliction for some people. Although today there are medications and we know much more about it. I'm sure you know that back in World War I, World War II, they called it shell shock.
Right.
Yeah. And now we call it PTSD, and we understand that phenomenally traumatic events that are beyond the range of usual human circumstances are at the cause of it. What I find, among other things, so interesting about it is that typically the response is more dramatic, and we see a great deal more pathology develop in people when the traumatic event is of human design, you know, such as the Boston bombings, the World Trade Center, concentration camps situations, as opposed to natural disasters like earthquakes and floods and things like that. Because it really, when it's of human design, these kinds of traumas really undermine our sense that life is reasonably predictable and fair, and it undermines our faith in humanity. We can see a more profound kind of psychiatric disorder following these kinds of events.
I have 2 more questions.
Okay. Sorry for talking so much.
That's okay. I know post-traumatic stress disorder. I know my nephew came back from Afghanistan with it.
Uh-huh, okay.
And I often wonder if he even... But I often wonder, do some people... And I've read a couple of books based on this, and some fiction, some nonfiction, where the character or the person doesn't even realize that there's something wrong with them. So if someone comes home from the war and is acting depressed or has the types of warning signs and they don't see it themselves, what are some of the signs that would indicate to someone that a son or a daughter or anybody in the Army or just in general might need some kind of help, or somebody that was there when this happened last week
sure.
might need some help?
Yeah, it's important that family members, spouse, whomever, recognize
yeah.
some of these things. The first thing you would be on the lookout for is a kind of a level of anxiety that was not present before the traumatic
mm-hmm.
event. And, you know, a traumatic event can be momentary, such as what happened in Boston, or it can be a year-long tour in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's not limited to a sudden, it can be a chronic ongoing thing. So anxiety would be one, what we call hypervigilance and an exaggerated startle response. A person is walking down a street and a car backfires, or there's a flat tire or something happens, and the person jumps 4 feet in the air. An exaggerated startle response might be one. A sudden change in sleeping patterns, where a person is waking up in the middle of the night with sweats and reports
mm-hmm.
some kind of dreams, either remembered or not remembered. A reluctance to engage in any activity that resembles or could be viewed as symbolizing whatever the trauma was.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, this would not in and of itself be pathological. Let's say a veteran doesn't want to go see a war picture. We can all
mm-hmm.
understand that. But
yeah.
if it becomes extreme, if the sight of soldiers in, let's say, Grand Central Station, who are
mm-hmm.
there now, or the sight of a parade would cause a panic attack or anxiety, then you really have to worry. General isolation, withdrawal, and then one of the big things is what we call in psychiatry a foreshortened sense of the future. There are people who have undergone extreme traumas with some frequency develop a sense of themselves that they're not going to live very long, that they don't
Ooh.
Have a real future ahead of them. And we see this most dramatically in concentration camp survivors, in people who have gone through a 12 or 13-month tour of duty in Iraq or Vietnam years ago, or Afghanistan, and they come back with an almost nihilistic sense that, well, you know, in the end, we all die anyway, so why should I bother doing this, that, or the other thing? When you start seeing these kinds of signs, you have to think seriously that whomever you're seeing them in may very well have post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's scary. So one last question. This is a biggie.
Okay.
This young 19-year-old that committed this act last week, what would cause someone that they claim is such a wonderful person, just looking at his eyes, he's frightening to look at, what would cause someone that's supposedly 19 and his brother to do something like that? What would be the impetus, or is there somebody behind him that's causing him to do it?
Well, of course, we'll never get a chance to talk with the older brother, the 26-year-old
brother.
No, he's
brother. Dead. That's really the sad part. It's too bad.
Yeah,
he's dead.
It is, because it would have been
important
to try and find out. My guess, and I'm just guessing here, you know, you always have to be
mm-hmm.
careful in psychiatry about
yeah.
either making diagnoses from afar or speculating too much. But purely speculating, my guess is that the older brother probably influenced the younger brother, which is not at
yeah.
all unusual. And the older brother did have a history of having gone back to Chechnya and Dagestan. And he spent, I think, 6 months there, and he was presumably radicalized there. We don't know. I'm sure they're looking into this as best they can right now,
mm-hmm.
the FBI and so forth. What would cause it? It's hard to know why this young man became radicalized. One of the
mm-hmm.
things that always strikes me when we look at these young men, and they're always young men
mm-hmm.
who carry out these atrocities, whether it's an Adam Lanza or it's the fellow in Phoenix or the fellow who did what he did in Aurora, Colorado, they're always young men who tend to be isolated, tend to be loners. The fellow in Aurora could very well be schizophrenic. Most schizophrenics, by the way, are not violent, but there are some that can be. And what we see is a level of isolation and disenchantment, and I can't help but wonder What kind of disappointment, what kind of despair did the older brother encounter in his attempt to fit in here in the United States? After all, he was here for many years, 10, 11 years, and he said he didn't have one American friend, and he didn't understand Americans. So you have to wonder what was wrong with him and what kind of influences were eating away at him. And eventually he apparently, at least as far as we may know now, he turned to radical Islam. The younger brother may just have gone along because he idolized the older brother. And hopefully we'll find out more. But right now it's all up in the air.
Well, his parents are coming here, they said, also to help in the investigation. So who knows what's going to happen or what they're going to tell him not to say or to say.
Yeah, and the mother the mother's already on record as saying that she thinks it's all a conspiracy put together by the U.S. and
she thinks that they got him in the throat so that he can't speak. I don't think that's the reason.
Yeah, well,
she's claiming. I know. Just looking at her, I begin to wonder where the apple doesn't fall far from the tree over there.
Who knows? Who knows? Then again, she's a mother, and it's a son, and
she's
going to
defend him, and she's going to defend the other one too. But what's really striking is that if the other one didn't have any friends, supposedly, and 26 years old, and he's been here for a very long time, why none of his professors or anyone realized that he was such a loner?
Yeah.
I mean, that would flag it.
Yep, he was into boxing, and who knows how much aggressive impulses were being, sublimated there. I hate to get into jargon, but it would always be better to be able to talk to whoever the person is, and of course, how much would this guy talk to you anyway?
He's probably not, but I'd be curious to see what would happen if you got him.
Well,
I don't think you want to. But before we close, let me just remind everybody that I'm taking a break, for 2 weeks. May 9th at 4 o'clock, we have Roger Ellery. I am so excited. I'm going to check on the time with him. I'm pretty sure it's 4 o'clock. And Roger likes the whole show, so he gets it all. We're going to talk about Candle Moth reviews and almost anything that he decides to talk about from England. You just never know what's going to happen with Roger Ellery. And I know Bethany's going to be here with me, Bethany, of course, because she and Roger communicate all the time. So we never know what we're going to talk about. On the 16th of May at 4 o'clock, John Lesicrow is going to be here, my guest. I am so excited, the Ophelia Cut, followed by Daniel Palmer Stolen. And then we're going to take a break again. And on May 30th, we have New York Times bestselling author for The King's Deception, Steve Barry. That's just some of what we have planned. And on June 6th, we have one more. And Mark, I know you're going to be on this one. We're going to have Thriller Mystery Thursday with another New York Times bestselling author. Can't tell you who. And a whole bunch of more people, including Karen Vaughn. That's going to be with us, and you never know what we're going to ask or what we're going to say, because, it's one of those, whatever happens on that day is going to happen. The following week, on June 13th, I'm going to be with Laura Griffin, with Exposed, New York Times bestselling romance author, followed by Joseph Barnett and Jane Connaughton, Mr. Joe, and he wrote a book about seeing and hearing ghosts for real. Should be interesting. And on June 20th, New York Times bestselling author Rayanne Thain and our very own Bethany Cross is going to be my second guest, and we're going to talk about her next novel. You just wait and see. That's going to be a hot show, let me tell you. So before I go, Mark, where can we get your books? And you're going to be on my show in September. I believe it's the 19th we chose. That was the date?
I don't have my schedule in front of me, but I know we do have a...
I think it's the 19th for you and Alan Topol, or the 26th, or whichever way it is. But
okay.
We're going to be talking about Love Gone Mad, and let me tell you, we just find out what's gone mad in this particular book. So just please tell everybody where we can get your books.
Okay, well, Love Gone Mad, Mad Dog House is available in virtually any bookstore. It's certainly available online at Barnes & Noble and at Amazon. It's also available on any e-reader for the whopping sum of $2.99.
Gosh, that much.
Yep, that much. It's really a lifestyle changer, I can be seen, so to speak, and reached at my website, which is www.markrubenstein, that's markrubenstein-author.com. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I try to respond to any email, and that's pretty much it. The book is out there, and the sequel's coming after the second book comes, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, we can almost tell what's going to happen. I'm afraid to see what's going to happen. And I do have Love Gone Mad right next to me, but like I said, because it's so good, I'll read it by the end of the week. By Saturday, I should have it written. It's going to take me longer to do the review. I want to thank everyone. I want to thank Mark so much. And
thank
Mark
you,
will be
friend.
Back with us at 4 o'clock on June 6th for Mystery Thursday with Karen Vaughn and Mark Brem, and I don't remember who else, whoever else I told to that's going to be on the show. And thank you, and I hope everybody has a good night. Thank you, Bethany. Thank you, Karen. And have a great night. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Fran. Thank you.